We're going to begin talking about DNA and RNA, which is what we mean by the genetic section. And we know DNA stores our genetic information that's used for the synthesis of proteins, including enzymes, which we talk a lot about. And it's found primarily in the nucleus and also some in the mitochondria. RNA has a lot of different functions, some of which are just being discovered. It's found in the nucleus, the cytosol, and the mitochondria. Messenger RNA, which we'll talk quite a bit about, is the messenger, if you will. It goes to the DNA and picks up the information and then carries it as a messenger word to translate it into a protein. Transfer RNA has to do with the activated amino acids, which we had a brief introduction to, and linking them together to begin to form the proteins or polypeptides. Ribosomal RNA is a structural component of ribosomes. And ribosomes we will briefly look at because they're important. That's where the protein synthesis occurs. There's small nuclear RNAs that we won't talk a lot about. And there's a lot of new discoveries and new research going on these tiny RNAs and the different roles that they have in genetics. And they're important. A number of viruses, including HIV, which we all know about, influenza, flu shots are now available. I got an email about that, polio. All those things, the RNA actually functions as the storage place of genetic information. So it's a big area, a lot of research going on. What does RNA exactly have to do with all this stuff? And apparently a lot more than was previously thought. Last year was the 50th anniversary of the discovery of this helical structure of DNA by Watson and Crick, and we mentioned them in our first lecture, introductory. They discovered that the helical, the spiral shape to DNA. And as we study these things, again, we're going to see a unidirectional flow, which goes from DNA, the store, RNA, the messenger carrier, to finally getting the proteins, many of which we talked about. So we want to keep in mind the overview, that flow that we're going to go through. And in that flow, a little more detailed diagram of the same thing follows this diagram, and that's where you start there with DNA. And we will talk about DNA its structure, about its replication, its repair, and its recombination. We will talk about then active DNA and inactive DNA, which are chromatins we will discuss, and then the process of transcription, and then processing and translation, and then finally the processing that gives us an active or functional protein. So we're going to go through kind of each of those steps. So it's kind of like a flow chart of what we're going to look at. So we're going to look at DNA, which again stores all the genetic information, and we'll look at transcription and processing into messenger RNA, and then finally how messenger RNA takes the stored information about how our protein should be put together and starts to translate those along with transfer RNA into the actual protein. And then finally, a few minutes, because we've already talked about it a little bit, the processing of the protein into an actual functional protein. That's going to get this tertiary structure, that primary structure, if it has any, such as in the case of hemoglobin. But the whole story starts with, and again, most of you have seen, the bases, of which there are five of them. And they are the pyrimidines and the purine bases. And the pyrimidines are cytosine, thymine, and uracil. And the purines are adenine and guanine. And on Wednesday, we will look in some detail at how they are synthesized, how they're made, these five bases. The structures are important, so you do need to know the structures of the five bases, as well as the one-letter codes, which in this case is very easy because it's C, C, U, A, and G. So not too much mystery there. But the structures of the bases are important, and on Wednesday, we will look in some detail at how they are synthesized, how they're made. Nucleic acid composition or nucleotide composition is basically two types of nucleotides that we call ribonucleosides with an S and ribonucleotides. We will primarily be involved in looking at ribonucleotides. You'll notice that the only difference between a ribonucleoside and a ribonucleotide is a phosphate group. So a ribonucleoside consists of a base plus the sugar ribose, and there's a picture in your notes. There it is. Ribose, so it's a little sugar. It's a serine. No, it's on my door and on that key I gave you. It's on that little key. You want? So base and ribose. So that's the sugar. Again, it's a pyrimidic ring. Small sugar is going to be really key to the structure of DNA and RNA. And also going to be really key is ribonucleotide is that phosphate group. So it's going to be real important in the backbone of the DNA, the helical structure of DNA and RNA. And then we have some structural drawings here to give you an example of side versus tide. Of a ribonucleoside, a deoxyribonucleoside, and a ribonucleotide. So again, notice the ribonucleoside is just the sugar ribose and one of the bases. And a deoxy, and we're going to talk about that when we talk about DNA, you'll notice this carbon right here, carbon number 2, does not have a hydroxyl group on it. So that's what deoxy means. That's what a deoxyribonucleoside is. It simply means that carbon has lost that OH group. And then finally, the backbone to the structure of DNA and RNA is the ribonucleotide. And again, the difference there is we have the addition of the phosphate group. The phosphate group. Some of the really important ribonucleotides and ribonucleosides, but in this case ribonucleotides because they have phosphates, are AMP, ADP, and ATP. They're not going to be as important in DNA and RNA in our genetic section as they will be in metabolism. We're going to emphasize them because they are where we get energy. We get energy in the form of ATP, so adenine triphosphate. You notice again the difference in these structures is mono, di, and triphosphate. So AMP only has one phosphate group, ADP has di or two, and ATP has triphosphate or three phosphate groups. And we're going to come back and talk a lot about that alpha, beta, gamma phosphate group and how we get energy from that when we start to talk about metabolism. There are also in biochemistry a number of nucleotide derivatives. Some of them will be important in the synthesis and breakdown of glycogen. And glycogen is one of the metabolic pathways we will look at. You remember we mentioned glycogen in passing in the introductory materials, how we store carbohydrates. So basically, glucose that we ingest is stored as a gigantic polymer called glycogen. And in several of the reactions in those synthetic pathways, we will see nucleotide derivatives, such as the one in the example here, where you have a glucose 1-phosphate that actually adds itself to an ATP, giving you ADP glucose. So kind of complicated structures, but we will see a number of those. So nucleotides are also involved in biochemical reactions. Not just, as we always think, just in DNA and RNA. But again, right now we're going to go on and concentrate a little bit on the genetic side of things. And the primary structure of DNA and RNA in the structure, the nucleotides are basically linked together. And again, we have polymers. We were talking about polymers much like we were talking about polymers and amino acids when we talked about proteins. And you notice they're linked together in what's called a 5-to-3' direction. And those have to do with the numbers of the carbons on the ribose ring. So 1', 2', 3, 4, and 5'. So you remember that ring. Starting with carbon number 1 is where the base is attached. You remember carbon number 2' is where we can have a deoxy situation, if that occurs, and it will sometimes. So this gives you an idea of kind of what the backbone looks like. And of course, we have a spiral structure, alpha helical or helical structure. And you can see again that the phosphate groups are key, which is why we care about the ribonucleotide, because the phosphates actually make up the backbone. How the thing is put together is joined by the oxygens in those phosphate groups, is how we polymerize all of those bases. Now, we all know there's base pairing, and we've all heard of that concept, and it turns out that the purine base always pairs with a pyrimidine, or to be specific, guanine with cytosine, and adenine with thymine or uracil, depending if we're talking about DNA or RNA. You can see here the example, a couple of examples of how the bases would pair, and again, it's a purine with a pyrimidine, so there you have a TA and a CG base pair, and you'll notice in the thymine, thymidine, adenosine base pair, you can see two hydrogen bonds. So again, hydrogen bonds, which they keep emphasizing hydrophobic effect, hydrogen bonds, amphiphilicity, all of that very important. It's important also in base pairing. So the way that they pair when we say things base pair is by hydrogen bonding. And you can see that there's two hydrogen bonds between the AT base pair and three in the CG base pair. And you should take note of those and know where those hydrogen bonds are. So in addition to knowing the structures of the bases, you should know how they pair with each other. And of course, we can take adenine and put in uracil for the thymidine, and it'll be basically the same thing. You'll have two hydrogen bonds. So that's kind of like the primary structure, or the way we talk about proteins, is base pairing. And the secondary structure is basically two of the chains kind of wrap around each other to form the double helix that we're all very familiar with. And the double helices in DNA and RNA have handedness, and that means they can go right or left, and generally they are right-handed helices, and the chains run anti-parallel. Anti-parallel meaning one of the chains goes 5' to 3', and you notice the other one that pairs with it goes 3' to 5'. So that's basically how these things pair, and again, there you have the example of the same base pairs that we just saw in the other picture, but now they're part of the actual DNA-RNA structure, where you have thymine, adenine with the two base bonding sites, and cytosine and guanine with three. One of the terms that is important in genetics is complementarity. And if the sequence on each basis, of course, has to be aligned so that they can base pair, otherwise clearly they would not come together. And it turns out that the number of guanosines always equals the cytosines, and adenines always equals the number of thymines in the pair. So they are complementary. We have base pairing all the way down the chain. As it forms this secondary structure, it forms two grooves that we call a major and a minor groove. As you begin to get the helical structure, major and minor from the double helix. And proteins, and more importantly, a variety of drugs interact with the functional groups on the bases that become exposed in those grooves. So that's why it's important to know that there are two grooves that form when the DNA spirals. Again, mainly because they're targeting a lot of drugs and a lot of research in the area of getting things to interact with the functionality of the bases in those grooves. So it kind of like opens up a little hole, a little kink in the chain, where you can devise something, hopefully, that will go in there. And that would be important in things like HIV and, again, influenza and things like that, if we could get them at a genetic level. So the structural forms of DNA differ or can differ in the handedness, so they can be right or left, though most are right. The length of the helix turn varies a little bit. The number of base pairs per turn a little bit. And because of the difference in base pairs per turn, the size of the major and minor grooves also vary a little bit. So we basically have different forms of DNA. We can class it into different forms based on those four issues. And so we can call it form A, B, or Z. And you can see the differences are fairly subtle. But the A and B forms of DNA are right-handed helices. Base pairs per turn in A are 11, B are 10. Z is a little bit different because it's left. It turns the other direction. DNA that turns the other direction. It's got 12 base pairs per turn in it. So again, that's DNA. Introduction. We will study DNA in quite some more detail. So RNA is a little different and simpler. The secondary structure of RNA is basically a single polynucleotide structure. And the RNA can also fold so that we have base pairing, we have the complementarity that we saw. And some RNA molecules contain portions that are single-stranded and double-stranded, so we can have both. And most of them, again, are running, they are running anti-parallel, so you go 5', 3', pairs up to 3', 5'. And you can see the helices, this is kind of a three-dimensional little view of what RNA looks like. And if you have 3D glasses, or you can see in 3D, it's a little bit easier. That's a stereoisomer pair, if you can see that. Now you can get a kind of 3D look at what it looks like. The secondary structure of the RNA is important for the different functions, particularly ribosomal RNA. The messenger RNA, which we'll be emphasizing the most, has some degree of secondary structure, but not as much as transfer and ribosomal RNA do. They have a lot of secondary structure. Some of the bases in the DNA and RNA, like some of the amino acids and proteins, can be modified, chemically modified. And generally that modification is via methylation. You can methylate some of the bases. And enzymes, much like proteases, called exo and endonucleases, and again the last three letters, A-S-E, tells you they're enzymes, can cleave RNA and DNA. The exonucleases act kind of like exopeptidases or exoproteases. They cleave from the end, so they take off nucleic acid from the end. And the endonucleases recognize specific base pair sequences in the center. So exos at the end and endos in the center of the spiral. The sequences that the enzymes recognize, the endonucleases recognize, are from about 4 to 8 base pairs in length. That's what they're recognizing. And of course, once we clip it or cleave it with an endonuclease, we can rejoin the fragments and make new combinations of DNA sequence. And we're going to look at the concept of recombination in DNA. So there are enzymes, endonucleases particularly, that cleave it, and then we can take those fragments and put it back together in different ways. So we can basically play with the structure. DNA can be denatured, so it can lose its secondary structure and go into single strand and then be renatured back into the double-stranded form. This reversible denaturation is essential for replication and transcription, as we will see. And also for things that we do in the lab, such as southern blotting and PCR techniques, polymerase chain reactions, all those work on the concept that we can denature and renature DNA as we want it. And there's three ways that we can denature it, to get rid of its secondary structure, kind of untwist it, put it into a single strand. We can do it with enzymes, we can do it artificially or chemically, say in the lab, or we can do it with heat. And the most common way that we describe denaturation, particularly in the introductory way, is the method that where we use heat, so via heat, denaturation of DNA via heat. And after you denature it with heat, you can actually look at it in a spectrophotometer, similar to the ones that you have in the biochemistry lab, where you will set the wavelength to 260 nanometers, similar as you do in the lab. And you can actually look at it, and you will see that as the absorption increases with increasing heat, so breaking the hydrogen bonding that's going on, breaking the strands apart, unstacking the bases, and then they become exposed. And this effect, if you will, this denaturation, as you see adding additional heat and breaking them apart, is called the hyperchromic effect. So it's just the name, a big word, the hyperchromic effect. And it turns out that by definition, we said that the temperature at which 50% of the DNA is denatured, we call the melting temperature of that particular DNA. We call it T subscript M, melting temperature. Now you can imagine, when we emphasize or we talk about base pairing, we know the GC bases are held together with 3 hydrogen bonds, and the AT only have 2. So it requires more heat, more energy to break apart the GC base pairs. And because the GC base pairs, again, have 3 hydrogen bonds, the higher percentage of GC base pairs at the higher PM, so we need more heat, more temperature, higher temperatures to break those apart than we do the AT ones. And this is a little picture of kind of what happens. You can plot this, again, using a spectrophotometer similar to the Beckman ones that you have in the lab now that you use. And you take your DNA, which is normal, not denatured, and that's the bottom picture there at zero time, zero temperature. And you can begin to add heat, and finally when you get about half of it, so you're halfway up the curve, we call that the TM, the temperature of melting. And then finally you get to a point where it's 100% denatured. You can make little graphs of this as you do this process, looking at the hyperchromic effect. Now we said we can break it apart, which is important, but more importantly we can put it back together. So we can renature it, renaturation. So in order to do that, though, of course, we've got to line the base pairs up so that they can recognize each other and initiate the base pairing. And once that happens, once we initiate that, then they quickly form those hydrogen bonds again and reassemble themselves. And there's a lot of factors that influence renaturation, and one of them is complexity of the DNA that you're trying to renature, DNA concentration, do you have enough there that they can see each other and you can initiate it and get them to come together, cation concentration, temperatures at which you're doing these things, all these things are factors that affect renaturation. And complexity, what we call complexity, is basically the sum of the non-repeating sequences that are found in the genome, and we're not going to have a lot of time to talk about the genome, but it's basically the organizational chart for DNA. And so if you look at a sequence of DNA, the one in your notes is a simple one. It just is A, T, A, T, A, T, A, T, A, T. It has a complexity of only two, so it's fairly simple. You only have two different base pairs. You only need to get two different base pairs together. If you look at a little more difficult sequence like A, G, C, A, T, G, A, C, G, again, there is repeating going on, but the complexity there is much more difficult. It's got a complexity value of 10, so it's a much more complex strand of DNA. And it requires a lot more time, and if you're doing this in the lab, a lot more effort to get the initiation going, to get this sequence to renature. Also, the solutions you're using, cation, sodium, potassium, magnesium, all of those being in solution, affect the phosphate groups, because we know that phosphate groups are highly negatively charged groups. So if you've got a lot of cations in there, they're going to bind with the negative charges on the phosphate group, and that will also influence the renaturation or rebuilding of the backbone, which, remember, primarily consists of those phosphates joining together. And, of course, renaturation, this makes sense, will only occur if you're below the TM. Because, of course, if you're at the temperature of melting, you're instead denaturing when you really want to renature. And what else? Studies have shown, or some of the research has shown, that most mammal DNA, most of the renatured mammal DNA consists of these highly repetitive sequences, the ones that are the easiest, the least complexity, easiest to put back together. And that's about it on renaturation. Hypochromic type. Hybridization, that's another term, can occur between complementary strands of nucleic acids that are derived from different sources. And the helix, the double-stranded helix that forms when you put these strands together from different sources, it's called a heteroduplex. And the heteroduplexes indicate homology between sources. So you can kind of look at that. Like, if you want to figure out what is the homology between two different mammal types, you can try recombining, denaturing, and then recombining their DNA and kind of see if it will. And if it does, to a large extent, then you say that there's a lot of homology between those two groups. For instance, when you take human DNA and mice DNA and you denature it and then try to put it back together, it doesn't very well. So we don't have a lot in common with mice. But if you do it with us and with chimpanzees, about 98% of it will form heteroduplexes. So that tells us that we have a lot of homology with chimpanzees, very little with mice. And okay, so that's hybridization. So that kind of, again, is introductory. Focus a lot on the very first diagram, because that's going to be key to kind of keep